On this episode...
When Broadway, between last year and this year, the cost to me of Broadway shows went up between 18 and 21%. Between this year and next year, they've gone up another 20%. So the only thing I can do is raise the ticket prices, and it's unfortunate, but that's, you know, that's the reality of it.
From the coveted corner booth in a little bar in the center of the Coachella Valley universe, welcome to another Big Conversation with Patrick Evans and Randy Florence. Gentlemen.
Thank you, Howard, very much. Yes, we are back at Skip Page's little bar. This is the center of the Coachella Valley universe, as far as Skip is concerned. Although, Skip just opened his brand new tap house in India.
The center of the universe has expanded greatly.
Or it's shifting eastward.
Yeah.
And so there we go. We were not invited to the opening party, though.
I noticed that.
Did you notice that? I noticed it, too. Yeah. But we're not saying anything. We're not bitter about it. I'm not bitter about it. I'm here with my co-host, great friend, Randy Florence.
I'm bitter.
Are you bitter?
A little bit.
About many things, I would imagine.
Yeah. Traffic today. Oh, my God.
Get off my lawn.
Get off my lawn.
You complain because people drive too fast, though.
They drive too fast. There's not a reason to go over 45 miles an hour in this city.
Yes, there is. We have to be places. There are things to
do. We would all get there.
Oh, my goodness. We're also here with John McMullen, our producer extraordinaire. John, thank you so much for all you do. He makes sure that this podcast gets uploaded to, and I would have no idea how you get it to go to the places it has to go where people can listen to it. If I were the producer, I'd be like, once we do an episode, come over to the house and I'll play it for you on my hi-fi stereo.
That's what I'm here for.
My hi-fi. There you go.
Not my Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
We are here. We have a great guest. And, you know, we've had a couple of guests who have been somewhat involved with the McCallum Theater. We had Gary Keefe.
Yes. He's somewhat involved.
He's somewhat involved. And we had Jeffrey Norman.
Jeffrey. Yep.
Who's my fellow Jersey boy.
Yeah.
And now we have Mitch Gershenfeld, president and CEO, and the gentleman who pretty much every show people see. You're the reason they see it. You picked it. Is that right?
Well, only the good ones.
Yeah, if you didn't like it, that wasn't Mitch's. Yeah.
If you didn't like it, it wasn't my show.
That's who picked the bad ones, Mitch?
Yeah, someone who is unknown to me.
It was Jeffrey. It was
Jeffrey.
Jeffrey. So, thank you very much for coming in.
Sure. I spend very little time in bars. I've never been here before. This is a lovely little bar. And the reason I don't spend time in bars is because I'm always at the theater.
You are always at the theater.
That's right.
We went to see, Randy and I went to see Tom Papa. And you guys have done a great job. You've beefed up the comedy circuit. You got Wanda Sykes coming in.
We have Kathy Griffin coming next month, and then we have Wanda Sykes coming in June.
You had to add a show for her.
We added a second show because she sold. And I was, you know, it's really interesting. You think the season is over in April or, you know, the end of April, and it's really not. People are here, and so we put Wanda on sale. She sold out immediately, put the second show on sale. That'll sell out. So it's fun, and I enjoy, because I like listening to comics, and so to be able to book them, this is something that our chairman, Gary Keefe, said we should do more comedy, so we're doing more comedy. It's working out great.
And he also, when he was on our podcast here, he said that one of the things he wanted to do was extend the season.
Right.
And entice those people who are here.
That's right.
Round.
Yeah, it used to be that, you know, we were like November to maybe the middle of April.
Yeah.
And now, you know, we go into October, maybe even September. We go out into May and June, and there's people here.
Well, Tom Papa was fantastic, but you are always, that was a Sunday night.
Yeah.
I frankly shouldn't have been at that show because I needed to get up in the morning. And I'm sitting there and I'm looking up at this, like, a really nice box seat. And I'm like, that's Mitch.
That's Mitch.
Yes. That's the presidential box. And I do the presidential wave to the audience down below, you know. Sometimes I'll throw some cookies down there.
That's like, he's got a lot of seats up there. And Randy and I, we're not.
Yeah, like there's a few open seats there next to Mitch. And
yes, those are for my friends.
Did you hear what he said? You heard what he said? Okay, good. I don't have to translate that.
Yeah, we'll move forward. Hey, I wanted to ask you, I want to go into the weeds a little bit, because this is interesting. The Wanda Sykes show.
Sure.
I noticed that she's doing this thing that we're seeing more often now where people aren't going to be allowed to take their cell phones in or at least be able to use them. Are you familiar with that process?
Sure, yeah.
So what exactly is she doing?
Well, they have these little pouches. I'm trying to remember the name of it, but it's a little pouch, and they make you put your phone in it, and then they lock it so that you can't take the phone out. And you can't use it, and that's so that you don't record or take photos and things like that. I've seen it done on Broadway.
Yeah.
A lot of comedians are doing it now. I believe when they opened the arena and they had Dave Chappelle, mm-hmm. I think they also use those pouches. Right. So it's interesting because when you leave the theater, they have to open. They have a special machine that opens it. So you better not forget, or else when you get home, you're not gonna be able to get your phone.
It's like coming home with the clothes that still have the little security thing on.
Yeah, that's right. When I went to Broadway, I didn't want to put mine in a bag, and so, you know, I put my phone away, and they said, well, you've got to put your phone in this bag. I said, I don't have a phone. They said, are you sure you don't have a phone? I said, absolutely sure I don't have a phone. I didn't take any pictures, but I didn't want to put my phone in a bag.
And they
but people
you?
Who come to the McCallum Theater need to put their phone in a bag. Otherwise, Wanda Sykes will get pissed off.
Got it.
Well, and that's not something that you want.
No,
she's,
no.
She's hilarious, and if she's mad at you, I think it would be...
Oh, you'll be in the next show.
I would not want to be on the wrong side of Wanda Sykes.
No, you know? No, absolutely. Well, I have to
for
tell
a
you,
lot
the
of reasons.
Tom Papa show was terrific. He's hilarious.
He is. He's great. You know, I like comics like Tom Papa. I like Jim Gaffigan. I like Nate Bargatze. You know, they don't really work blue. And it's refreshing.
It is refreshing. I think there were two F-bombs in the Tom Papa, and yeah. They were, like, perfectly appropriate.
Well,
for
and Lewis Black last year, I mean, that was before he'd walked on stage, you were hearing the F-bombs.
Oh, my God, Lewis Black.
Well, the first time I had a comic that worked blue, I had an opportunity to have Whoopi Goldberg on the stage. And I went to, this was before I was CEO, so Ted Gattis was the CEO. And I said, Ted, I have an opportunity to do Whoopi Goldberg. I know that President Ford, who was on our board, is not a big fan of Whoopi Goldberg. She's made a lot of fun of President Ford and things. So do you think it's okay to book Whoopi Goldberg? And he says, well, let's call President Ford. So he gets President Ford on the speakerphone, and he said, President Ford, we have an opportunity to have Whoopi Goldberg, and we wanted to make sure you were okay with it. And President Ford said, I have two questions. First, will the theater make money? And I said, yes, sir, we'll make money. And he said, second, do I have to go? And I said, no, you don't have to go. He said, then by all means have Whoopi Goldberg. So we actually counted the F-bombs on that when there were 43.
Wow.
And I think we probably had more from various different people over time. I mean, comics, they either work that way or they don't. And what's great about Nate Bargatze is now the highest selling comic in the world. I mean, he is selling out arenas twice. You know, he'll do like 35,000-40,000 tickets, and he works clean.
He's
so,
one of the most hilarious people, and it's not just his material. His delivery is so unique and so funny. I mean, he can tell lots of boring stories and make them sound hilarious. He just is that guy.
But you know what's so interesting about really the whole entertainment business these days is that it's become so changed because of social media. So a comic will be, you know, struggling playing clubs, you know, making a couple of hundred bucks a night. They get a viral TikTok video, and all of a sudden they're making six figures. This kid, Matt Rife, is a perfect example. This guy, I had talked to his agents, I don't know, a year and a half ago, and it was like a $10,000 act. And all of a sudden, you know, by the time I'm ready to pull the trigger on something, he is playing arenas all over the world, and he's, you know, six-figure money. And this is what happened. So it was interesting with Nate Bargatze, because I was looking at him when he was, you know, making far less. And I said, well, this would work at the McCallum Theater. And then again, like, you blink, and all of a sudden, he's the highest-paid comic in the world.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So he's not coming to McCallum.
He's not coming to McCallum. I hope he comes to the Acrisure because I'll buy a ticket.
Yeah, I would buy it. Yes. I mean, and that, you know, there was a conversation in our newsroom when they built the Acrisure Arena, like, how is this going to impact other entertainment venues around the valley? But the truth is, the act that you're going to get for a 12,000 seat thing, very different than the act you're going to get for a 1,200 seat auditorium. So, like, it really doesn't have a huge impact on what you guys are doing.
No, and I think it's actually a great thing for the Valley because it's like, you know, if you're in New York and you want to go to a restaurant and the restaurant's crowded, well, you go next door and there's another restaurant. If there's more entertainment venues in the Valley, I think it just lets people know that this is a place where they can have a lot of options. So if people are going to see Madonna at the arena, they can still come to our place and see what we have, you know, that night. Plus, I like the fact that you know, the arena will announce somebody like Luis Miguel, and I can say, well, we had Luis Miguel.
Yeah.
We knew Luis Miguel.
Yes, that's right.
So talk a little bit about the planning of a season, and then tell us what you put. But where do you find these acts? You go, there are like big...
That you go to a trade show to see performers?
There are a couple of trade shows a year. There's one for the Western States, and then there's the national one called the Association of Performing Arts Presenters, and it's in New York, and it's been going on for 50, 60 years, and it's a trade show. I mean, literally, you go into a big hall, and there are booths, and all the agents have booths, and they're hawking their artists. So
and they have what? Snippets of the act, or
well, they'll have you know they'll have usually a screen, an iPad, or something you can see. You know, you can see this. They'll have printed materials, and they'll you know they'll be talking about it. And the fact is that there might be in this conference like 5,000 different artists that will be represented. 90% of them are absolute crap, and my job is to find the 10% that's not. And so, you know, that's kind of where it starts. But there are only like three or four agencies that handle Broadway shows. So the Broadway shows are massive because they're touring around the country and they're anywhere between like four trucks. We had Les Miserables, which was 11 trucks.
Yeah.
And so those things, you know, you sort of have to figure out where on their route you're gonna be. And so if it fits into the schedule, you sort of put those in first. And then there's, you know, the pop and the jazz and things like that. And then there's classical music. And you know, I have next season Yo-Yo Ma, for example. And he books way in advance. You know, he'll book 2 years in advance. So you sort of have to know the agents who handle various kinds of things. They're, you know, because there's a very specific group of agents that handle classical music and a very specific ones that handle jazz. I mean, there's Ted Curlin Associates in Boston. Their roster is jazz. So if I'm looking for jazz, that's one of the places that I'm going.
And you've established a relationship with these people over the years.
Sure. And a lot of these agents I've known for, you know, 30, 40 years. And so that also helps because, one, they know me and they know that I'm not going to, you know, mess around that I'm an honest person. And they also know the McCallum. And that the McCallum is a great place to play, that artists love playing the McCallum, we treat them well, we honor our contracts, and we're not going to screw them over. And that, I think, you know, for an artist, that's one of the biggest things. You want to play in a place where you're appreciated, where, you know, we can fill the auditorium, and where they're going to get the money that they, you know, they need to get, and they're going to have fun.
And this is famously why, because you did retire.
Why won't
you retire?
You've retired
a couple of times. And Harold Masner told you no.
Yeah. Well, I retired and they hired somebody. It didn't work out. They asked me to come back. I came back. I closed the theater for COVID, actually 4 years ago to the day we're taping this. And then they hired another guy. And a year later, he was gone and they asked me to come back. I reopened the theater. We were shut down for 604 days, I think.
Oh.
And so we reopened. And then Harold announced at a board meeting that I was staying for 3 more years. And he said, "Isn't that right, Mitch?" And you don't say no to
the
Harold
Masner.
Yes,
so,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yes, yes, Harold.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit. You kind of alluded to this or talked about it. Gary has taken over.
Yeah.
And Gary is not Harold. So, and he's got his own, you know, definite vision of where he wants to take the theater.
Sure. Look, Harold was an amazing chairman. I mean, you know, he was very involved, but he also knew, you know, that we knew what we were doing. You know, with Harold, he concentrated on the financial part of it. We became very, very solid financially. Gary obviously has a great background in the entertainment business, so he knows a lot of this. And, you know, he sort of knows different parts of the entertainment business. So it's easy to work with Gary. I can talk to him about artists. He can suggest artists, and I can tell him why I think that would or would not, you know, be a good thing for the McCallum. And we have those conversations. So I think coming after Harold, I think Gary is a great choice for chairman. It's working out very, very well.
So tell us a little bit about the season that you have selected upcoming. You know, you make this big announcement, now people can get their season tickets.
Yeah, we go on sale to the public on April 12th, We have a donor on sale for 4 days before that. You know, it's funny. Every year when I finish booking the season, I tell my wife that I think it's not going to be a good season, that I didn't book a good season. It's going to, you know, I feel terrible about it. It's going to be a failure. And she says, you always say that, and it's always a successful season. This season, I finished, and I said, you know, I feel good about this season. So
uh-oh.
I'm not, you know, now I'm now I'm a little concerned. But I do think we have some really, really good Broadway stuff. And, you know, you talk about the other venues in town. We're really the only theater that physically can do Broadway because we have the physical plant for it. You have to have the fly loft so you can have, you know, drops and things. So we can do that where the casinos can't do it. You know, obviously it's not going to be at the arena. But so the Broadway stuff, I think it's going to be a good season. There's two shows that I'm bringing back that were just here a couple of years ago, but they did so well. One is Come From Away, which is an amazing story. It's a story about 9/11.
Yep.
When they closed the airspace to the United States, and there were all these planes that were coming over from Europe that were in the air, and they couldn't land in the United States, so they all landed in Gander, Newfoundland, in Canada. And the story is about how this little town of, you know, just a few thousand people took care of 7,000 people who, you know, weren't supposed to be there, were not getting news out of the United States. They didn't know what was going on. And it's just such an amazing cathartic story. So we did it a couple years ago. It sold out. We're going to bring it back. The other show that we're bringing back is a show that is one of the funniest shows that, and it's still on Broadway, and that's The Book of Mormon, which is a very funny show. And it's very irreverent. It's very profane. But it's just hilarious. I remember when I first saw it on Broadway, I'm thinking to myself, our audience, I mean, how are they going to react to this? I mean, the content, the language. And I was watching the audience, and I was watching people who had gray hair. And they were all laughing hysterically. So I thought, well, we can bring that. So,
but that's a bit of a risk. I mean, that was a roll of the dice.
I think it was a roll of dice, and you know, it paid off, and so we'll bring it back.
Very, that's very one, funny if, show. If President Ford were still alive and on the board, you would have had to have called him and said, "We're."
might have, although they didn't make they didn't make fun of him. They make fun of what's interesting about Book of Mormon, and they were very smart about it. When it opened on Broadway, the Mormon Church could have taken the position that, you know, we got to shut this down. This is terrible. How, you know, they're making fun of us. They took out a full-page ad in the Playbill on Broadway, and it said, if you like the Book of Mormon, the show, we'll send you the real Book of
Mormon.
That's
fantastic.
And I thought, what a brilliant PR move.
Wow.
By them. They, you know, they embraced it, and they said, well, okay, here's the Book of Mormon, but we'll show you the real Book of Mormon. I thought that was a very, very clever thing.
It's brilliant.
For them to do.
I mean, it was the right thing to do.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
So the other shows that we have, and I'm real happy because these are some new ones that are recent. They're either still on Broadway or recently on Broadway. One is Dear Evan Hansen, which is it won Best Musical. It's a fascinating story. It's about social media and teenagers and how social media can be used for good or bad, and how people can manipulate what people see on social media to get, you know, a wrong impression. It's a really interesting musical. It's one of these thoughtful musicals. Not necessarily a happy ending, not a bad ending, but not a happy ending. But it's one of these sort of teenage angst, but put to very good music.
Which is really what's
important. I can relate to this because my daughter just had her phone taken away today at school, and she's talk about angst.
There you go.
Oh.
Another musical which is on Broadway now and is enormously successful, and it's an interesting concept. The show is called Six, S-I-X, Six, and it's the six wives of Henry VIII. And the show is basically, it's a rock concert. You have these six women, and they're in these wild costumes, and you have a rock band, and they sing songs about what happened to their character when they were married to Henry VIII. So you start out with beheaded, divorced, died, beheaded, survived, So you have these six. You have these six women, and they each sing their story. And you know, it's one of these musicals. It's 90 minutes long. There's no intermission, and it's just like going to a rock concert.
My 12-year-old granddaughter saw it in Sacramento and loved it.
Yeah. Really?
It's a lot of fun. And another musical we have is the Tina Turner musical, which is her story, and of course all that great music. We also have. Now I'm forgetting. We have other Broadway musicals that escaping me right now. But
now you bring back frequently, like Pink Martini.
Yeah.
Usually does a stint. What every season?
Every other year.
Every other year.
Yeah.
Okay. And so, but also Storm Large.
Yeah.
She's wildly popular here in the desert.
Storm is Storm started out being with Pink Martini,
right.
And when she sang with Pink Martini, she sings Pink Martini songs. But she has her own band, which is called the Boner Band, and she does songs that she likes to sing. And she's really an amazing performer.
I've seen her a couple of times at the McCallum, and Alan, our in-house counsel over there, he came up to me and my wife at a charity event, and he was talking about Storm Watch. He says, I want to tell you something. And she has all her clothes on, but she is the sexiest woman I have ever met in my life. That's a direct Alan Horowitz quote.
She is a very sexy woman, but a really tremendous voice. Very funny.
It's very funny. Yeah. She did a version of I've Got You Under My Skin.
Yeah.
And I remember her intro to this because she's like, I know, you guys know Frank. And Frank did it as a guy in love. So I'm going to do it more like, imagine someone loves you too much and they come and carve their name in your bathroom mirror with their own blood. That's the version of the song. And then she did it, and it was like, oh, my God, it's unbelievable.
And Storm, she's the sweetest person. I remember Barry Humphries, who was Dame Edna. He was the actor who played Dame Edna. We became friends over the years because he would, Dame Edna would be at the McCallum. And he was the artistic director of the Adelaide Cabaret Festival. And he invited me to come over to Australia. And I went and he said, there are two artists that I really think you should see. One was Meow Meow and the other was a fellow named Michael Griffiths, who I subsequently had play at the McCallum. And he said, who should I bring next year to the Cabaret Festival? And I said, have you heard of Storm Large? He said, no, tell me about her. And I told him everything about Storm. And he said, I must have her. And so she went over.
How many people have said that?
So she went over to Australia and has been there several times since.
Wow.
And Meow Meow is performing with...
Meow Meow's with Pink Martini this time. And Meow Meow she's hilarious. I mean, she's a classically trained soprano, but she puts on this crazy wig and she'll come out on stage pulling this long chain while singing a depressing Weimar era German song. And then on the chain is attached this cart which has her set, and she'll keep singing while she's putting together the set pieces, it's really good singing mixed with physical comedy, and she's a really unique performer. When the first time I had her do her solo show, she said, I'm going to crowd surf. And I said, no, you're not. And she said, no, I always crowd surf. And I said, well, the people sitting,
you don't want to dive
coming
into the first two rows.
The first five rows. That's our donors, and they're elderly people, and they're frail.
They all have osteoporosis.
And she said, in the middle of the show, she launched herself into the audience. Now, I'm in the fifth row center, and I see her, and I go, oh, my God, she's going to kill people, because you had all of the big philanthropists. You had Joanne McGrath and Helene Galen and Donna McMillan and all these, very well-known people in the community. And they caught her and they start passing her back.
Wow.
And she gets to me and I'm holding like half of her and she says, stop. And then she said, someone get me a glass of scotch. And we had an usher bring her a drink and she drank it. She said, now send me back. And we sent her right back onto the stage past those same people. And that was Meow Meow.
That's pretty cool.
I wish I could do that in the middle of a weather cast. Just lean over to the
podcast.
Somebody give me a glass of bourbon.
Just dive towards me and John right now.
Well, there you go.
I want to talk to you about one of the buzzes. I got to work as an usher at the McCallum for a little while, and one of the buzzes there all the time was Mitch's Picks. the shows that you specifically picked out. What does it take to be a Mitch's pick?
Well, it's basically artists that I think are terrific that people haven't heard of. So I've done some that have become very, very famous, like the group Two Cellos. We brought them in. Nobody knew who they were. And, you know, of course, they were a sensation. We brought them back. And then by the time the next kind came around, they were too big for us. So we've done that with them. I think the Piano Guys, which is another great group. So various performers that I think need some attention. And if I put my name on it, I figure there are some people that will buy tickets, even if they're not familiar with the artist. So that's I always try to have a few things on the season. Being a former tuba player for many years ago, I always try to bring brass music to the theater. And next
year, is it hard to find a lot of tuba acts at this point?
Oh, I know where they're all. I know where they're all hidden.
You know where they are.
But you know, if I booked only on my own taste, we'd have a lot more tuba than we have now. But I have a group next year that I'm excited about. It's called the Tenting Brass Ensemble, and it is 10 brass players, all female, all from Norway, and the trumpet player who leads it. Her name is Tina Ting, and so she has this 10 women in this brass ensemble, and they're fantastic. So
what kind of music do they play?
Classical, we've had the Canadian brass and different groups. So this one is our all-women Norwegian brass group. So they'll probably play some Grieg and some, you know, Norwegian music.
It sells itself. I'm in.
Norwegian brass.
Well, I was a trumpet player. I share, you know, the love of great brass music with Mitch. And you've conducted. You like to get in front of the band every once in a while.
Well, I had for about 8 years. I did a concert band, and I would. It was a real vanity project, but I'd hire all the top studio players from Los Angeles. I mean, the ones that are on every movie, and we'd do a concert band, and it would be everything from, you know, serious pieces to Sousa marches and fun things. I had we did a Casey at the Bat. And the poem was read by Gavin McLeod, who was fantastic. And, you know, so we do some fun things like that. I did Rhapsody in Blue with the pianist Jeffrey Siegel. So not doing that anymore. But it was a lot of fun, and it sort of kept my music chops, happy.
Still have a tuba in the house?
No, I
no?
don't. And, you know, it's funny. Thomas Lauderdale from Pink Martini asked me last year, he said, when we're here next year, I want you to play a tuba solo with Pink Martini. And he gave me a piece that they play, and it's a clarinet solo. And he said, transcribe it for tuba, and you'll play it next year. And I said, well, I don't play anymore. I don't have a tuba. He said, well, you've got time. Get a tuba and practice. So I did. I borrowed a horn from Palm Springs High School. And for about 3 weeks, I went back to my, you know, school days, and I was trying to warm up and
get that embouchure just right.
The lips don't last.
It's not like riding a bike. Eh?
And so I gave it up and told Thomas. I said, I'm sorry. I don't want to embarrass myself. If I could, because at one time I was a professional player, and so I could play this stuff, but not anymore. I mean, it was like 40 years ago, so that's not happening anymore. So I'm not playing the tuba.
All right, well, let me dig into your background here a little bit. So you were a professional horn player, tuba player.
Yeah.
Where are you originally from, and how did you get into...
I'm originally from Philadelphia, and I started playing tuba in high school, and I decided to be a
why?
Because I was a big guy,
okay,
and I could carry the sousaphone.
Okay.
I wanted to play the oboe. And my band director said, there's no oboe in the marching band, and you're a big guy, and you're going to carry a sousaphone. So that's what I did. And then I played the tuba. And when I was a freshman in college, I was studying music.
Where'd you go to college?
It's now called University of the Arts in Philadelphia. Then it was called Philadelphia Musical Academy. And Leonard Bernstein and Alan J. Lerner were coming to Philadelphia to premiere their brand new musical called 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. They were going to do it for a month in Philadelphia and then take it to Broadway. So I'm an 18-year-old college freshman. I had a friend who was playing trumpet in the band, and he said, why don't you cut school? You can sit in the back of the hall, and you can see Leonard Bernstein in person, and you can hear this music. It's never been played before. I said, great. So I'm sitting in the back, and Bernstein had written this very difficult part that was about 40% bass trombone and 60% tuba. So they hired a good bass trombone player who could, you know, play some umpapas on the tuba. Well, Bernstein had written two virtuoso parts, and the tuba part was a very virtuoso kind of part, and this guy couldn't play it. So I see my friend whisper to the contractor, who whispered to the conductor, who whispered to Bernstein. Bernstein turns around and points a finger at me and, you know, come here.
Wow.
And I said, yes, sir. And he said, do you play the tuba? And I said, yes, I do. He said, well, you get your tuba, and I'll listen to you play, and maybe I'll hire you. So I ran downstairs. I got a cab. And I got to my apartment. I'm yelling at the cab driver that Leonard Bernstein wants me to play the tuba. He thought I was insane. So I get back there. I played for Leonard Bernstein. He hired me. And I played this month of the show. At the end of the month, the contractor from Broadway said, why don't you come to New York and you can play the show on Broadway? And like a schmuck, I said, I'm a freshman in college. I can't quit school to go do that.
No.
And he said, well, you are a schmuck, and good luck to you.
So and now show, he's sitting here doing our podcast.
That's right. Well.
So the show goes to Broadway, and it lasted 7 performances, and then because it was
it needed you.
It wasn't a great show.
I mean, looking back on it, the music was Bernstein. It was brilliant, but the book, and you know, it wasn't the right. It was one of those shows that was not right for the time. You know, it was like 76, and we were, you know, coming off the Vietnam War, and this was kind of a real kind of anti-war, you know, racial conflicts and all this kind of thing. And I think the audiences just didn't want to see that. Plus, Broadway in the 70s really kind of sucked. So
New York in the 70s was pretty terrible.
Yeah, yeah. So that was my introduction to playing professionally.
But if you had done it, you would have only had to left school for 7 weeks.
Or 7 days.
you could.
I mean, the show lasted less than a week.
Oh, yeah, seven performances.
Yeah. Yeah, it was less than a week.
Oh, you couldn't even miss a class.
It opened on Tuesday and closed on Sunday.
You would have been right back.
So I could have come. Yeah, I just could have just cut class for a week.
But that's an incredible story. Leonard Bernstein hired you.
Yes, he did. That was my first professional job as a musician.
And you're just sitting in the audience watching, and he just points at you.
Yeah, yeah.
That's unbelievable.
That's a pretty good story.
It was one of those things that you wish they had cell phone cameras back then. You know.
Are you ever, do you ever get starstruck anymore?
Only when he's on Eye in the Desert, he gets a little nervous.
you know, there's artists that I book because I want to meet them and see if they're nice people or jerks. And one of the ones was Anthony Bourdain. And I booked Anthony Bourdain to come in and do a lecture thing that he did. And I thought, you know, I liked what he did on television. And I thought, he's either going to be like a real jerk, like he sort of comes off on television as being kind of a curmudgeon, or he's going to be a nice guy. As it turned out, he was a great guy. And I really enjoyed, we had him twice.
Who were the jerks?
I'm not going to say.
But
there are a number of them. And you know, if they sell tickets, I still book them anyway. You know, I just, yeah.
Mitch's picks, have you ever had any misses?
Oh, my gosh. There is a group who I still think are absolutely brilliant. It's a Korean violinist named Hong Kyuk Ju and a Russian violinist named Alexei Igudizman. So they go, the name of their act is Igudizman and Ju, but it's J-O-O. And so these guys, they do, you know, you had like Victor Borga and Peter Schickele, you know, mm-hmm. P.D.Q. Bach. They did classical music comedy kind of things. Well, Igudizman and Ju do that. And I think you have to be very inside to get the jokes. So,
I mean, Peter Schickele, you had to be a pretty knowledgeable about classical music to get a lot of his stuff.
His stuff was actually much more accessible, as was Victor Borga.
Oh, Victor, yeah.
Igudizman and Ju,
deep inside.
I've got a master's degree in music, and I just barely got the jokes. So I booked this act, and I'm telling everybody, I mean, all our donors, and I'm saying, this is the greatest act, you're going to love this. And we sold out the hall because I kept talking about how great this show was. And so they start doing their bit, And the only people in the auditorium that laughed were me and Marilyn Benikowski, who was with the Desert Symphony back then.
Yes.
And everybody else absolutely hated them. So we get to the end of the show. Now, you have to understand, these people sell out big venues in Europe and get, you know, huge ovations because the European audience tends to be a little more musically literate than the American audience. So they get to the end, and they have, you know, they take their bow and they go off stage to come back to do their encore. The applause was absolutely done before they left the stage.
Oh.
And I felt so bad for these guys, and they were like, what the hell did we do wrong? I'm like, no, no, it's not you.
And did you take grief after the show?
Oh, my God, I still get.
Really?
You're not going to bring that as good as one and Drew back, are you? You know? Yeah. So, yeah, there are hits and misses. Fortunately, there's more hits than misses. So
what do you consider your biggest find?
Gosh, probably the 10 tenors.
Yeah.
Those guys.
Oh, they come back quite frequently now.
Yeah, and those guys, they're so amazing because, you know, it's... You think 10 tenors, you think it's going to be 10 guys standing in a line singing opera. And they have, some of the guys are pure opera singers. Some are like musical theater voices, and some are pure rock and roll tenors. And so they do everything on their program from like Bohemian Rhapsody to Nessun Dorma, you know, from Puccini. And it's all just brilliant. And it's choreographed, and it's just an amazing show. So I saw that, I don't know, back around 2009 or 10, and I brought them in 2011. We sold out three shows. Our box office manager told me I was crazy. You can't book three shows. Nobody knows who they are. We sold the three. The next year, I booked six, and she said, you're crazy. I know you got three. You're never going to get six. We sold out six. The next year, I could only get them for three, and she said, you're crazy. Only three?
Last year, one of the best things I saw at the McCallum was the Charo show.
She's something.
Oh, she's amazing.
Well, the show that was going on in the lobby before we even went into the theater was something incredible. Yeah. How did that come together?
You know, Charo is one of those performers where I brought her here. I can't remember how many years ago it was, you know, I always enjoyed her performance, and we had her last year. We're having her come back next season. She'll be with the comic Gary Muldier, who's very, very funny
Gary.
Guy.
Gary Muldier is one of my most favorite people. He used to text me jokes. He used to text, he's like, is this funny? Like, let me know.
Yeah, he's terrific. So Charo, and what was interesting is that we had a little event for our donors the next day where I interviewed Charo. And I knew all about her classical guitar study, and she studied with Segovia. I mean, you know, she was legitimately a great Spanish guitar player. So I started talking about that, and she was, like, really floored. She said, nobody ever asked me about that. All they want to know is Coochie Coochie.
Coochie Coo.
Yeah. You know, well, we got to Coochie Coochie, but we started with the other stuff. And it was, I mean, she's a lot of fun. She's a lot smarter than her character is. And a really, really lovely, lovely person.
So you touched on something a little while ago, and I want to come back to it. To 2020.
Yeah.
At the McCallum. You had to shut down. What I have heard from people who worked there at the time was how incredible management was helping everybody get through that.
Well,
how did that impact you the day you found out we're going to have to close down?
Well, I mean, obviously it was difficult. We were getting pressure from customers for a couple of weeks before because everybody was, you know, nobody knew exactly what was going on with COVID, and, you know, people were concerned. And so there were some people that were saying, you better shut down. Why are you doing shows? You're going to kill people and, you know, all this. And finally, we got we got a fax from the health department, the Riverside County Health Department, saying we're shutting down all public venues. So
that's how the message came to you.
That's how the message came to us. And we were supposed to have a show that night, and we had to cancel it, obviously, and then had to cancel everything for the rest of the season. And then I thought, well, this thing will be over by next season. So we booked another season, and then we had to cancel that whole season. But during that time, you know, we wanted to do something for our employees. So everybody kept their full health insurance for the whole time, and then everybody got a salary. It wasn't 100%. It was, you know, usually between 40% and 60%, but we kept everybody, you know, doing something and kept everybody with their health insurance. And I, you know, I think that was an important thing for us to do. We were fortunate. We had the funds available to do it. Now, we obviously afterwards we got the money from the government, you know, the shutter
PPP venues. Loans and this sort
of. Yeah. But we knew it was important to do. So even before we knew about the government money, we did it anyway because it was the right thing.
Yeah. Well, like I said, the people that I've talked to there just have so many amazing things to say about management. So
well, it speaks so well of the McCallum and again Harold's leadership that you guys did have the funds and the ability because so many arts organizations did not. And yeah. You know, a lot of people who worked in the arts really suffered.
That's true. A lot of venues shut down. A lot of people out of work. I felt bad for a lot of the performers. Because they didn't have that safety net, and it was very tough. A lot of you know, the opera companies and theater companies went out of business. So it was it was a really, really difficult time.
And as you opened, it wasn't easy. I mean, you still had rules in place.
The mask thing was a big deal.
We required vaccination cards, and we required masks. Right. So I was called a Nazi. Yep. I was called every name in the book because we weren't, you know, letting people do this.
Particularly ironic.
We even had some artists that were, I won't book anymore because they were very vocal about, we shouldn't require masks and this and that and the vaccines. But this was, and again, this was Harold who was pretty insistent that we needed to do this to keep people safe. And we did keep people safe. So, it's one of those situations. When I started the McCallum in 2000, we were like $7.5 million in debt. And the CEO at the time, Ted Giadis, worked out of that deficit. And then when I took over as CEO in 2012, we were basically still somewhat in debt, not much. But Harold wanted to concentrate on accumulating revenue. So that's what we worked on. And we have a nice buffer now so that, you know, we still have to raise money, obviously, but we have that buffer that when we need something, like especially capital things, our orchestra pit is going to need to be replaced in the next couple of years. That's $2 million.
Yeah.
And
wow. So
fortunately we have it. We don't have to go specifically fundraise. Oh, we don't have an orchestra pit. Give us money. So we know we have
But that's a great naming, right?
Well, that's true. We have
the Patrick Evans orchestra pit.
I want the Randy Florence orchestra pit. And he's sitting on it right now. You need it.
Well, but, you know, we have a roof that's never been replaced. So
Patrick Evans roof.
There's another. Yeah.
I'm a weatherman. I'll put a roof on a place where we get 3 inches of rain a year. You bet. That's a safe bet. Yeah.
So we're able to, you know, and all of our technical equipment, our audio equipment, lighting equipment, it's all computers now. So computers have to be replaced every, you know, 5 years or so. So we have funds that we can do that on keep our equipment in top shape.
All right. So you're committed to do this a few more years.
I'm not saying I'm committed to anything.
Because honestly, it doesn't really matter what he says.
That's true. I don't know. We have to find out if Gary holds the same sway.
I'm making no commitments, but I am working on the 25-26 season.
Okay.
But going back to the 24-25 season, a lot of good stuff. We've got Bernadette Peters, Mandy Patinkin's. We got some Broadway legends.
Mandy Patinkin's coming.
And we're promised this time that he'll do an uplifting show because last time he did kind of a depressing show. But they promised us that he's in a better mood now.
Okay, yeah, he's a kind of a moody guy. I've read a bunch of stuff because he's one of my favorite actors. I, of course, Princess Bride, he's incredible. But then Homeland.
Yeah.
I mean, he was just so brilliant.
He's an unusual guy. Brilliant performer, but, you know, it's not someone I book so I can hang out with him.
Right. He's not the guy you want to sit down and have a beer with after the show.
Probably not.
That was very different. Probably not.
Yeah. And then, you know, Paul Anka will be back, and he's another interesting guy.
I'll tell you my Paul Anka. Can I tell you my Paul Anka?
Yeah,
and it didn't happen at the McCallum. It happened at Fantasy Springs. Because he came in one year and he did the entertainment for the Sinatra golf tournament. And the way they could do that was he was booked to do Fantasy the next night. So Saturday night, he performs for Barbara and the small group at the Sinatra. Sunday night is his, you know, in the Special Events Center. And he was terrific. He did a short show. And so I talked to the guys at Fantasy. I said, can I get a ticket for Sunday night? Because I'd like to see the whole show. And they said, yeah, come on. And so I go, and I sit down, and there are these ladies and their husbands. They're roughly my age. And they're like, you're a little young for a Paul Anka fan. I said, I love Paul Anka. I mean, like, I adore the guy. He's great. They're like, really? And like, we're singing all the songs. And finally, they're like, well, we need to tell you that we're his daughters. So three of his daughters. And so the show's going on. And at the end, they're like, you should come backstage and meet Dad. I'm like, that's very cool, but I've heard you alluded to it, and so I don't know. No, we insist. Come backstage. You need to come back and meet Dad. And so we're going backstage, and there's kind of a group, and you think, okay, there's going to be this entourage. I'll be fine. Well, it thins out. People fall off. By the time we get actually backstage, it's the three daughters, their husbands, and me. And Anka comes out from his little dressing room, and this time he had little kids, and he comes out and he goes, well, the little one's asleep, so we gotta be quiet. He's shaking hands with the sons-in-law and giving hugs to the daughter, and he gets to me and he stops and he looks at me and goes, who the fuck are you?
And then you started singing "You're Having My Baby" and walked out.
Just like, and the daughter, I'm like, I didn't know what to say. I'm like, you don't really have an answer to that question when Paul Anka asked it. And the daughter's like, oh no, Dad, this is Patrick, and he works for the TV station, and he's a great guy. He's a huge fan. He goes, thanks. That was it.
Wow.
You know,
it's interesting. Anka, there's not a lot I'm going to say, but I will say that he has good moods and bad moods. And it's always better when he's in a good mood. So we had the show this year, and we had a little meet and greet for some people, and he had them in the dressing room. They were taking some photographs, and so we were finished that, and I start leaving. He goes, Mitch, come here, and I'm like, oh crap, what's he gonna do now? And he said, yeah, let's get a photo together. I'm like, you're asking me to do a photo? And he puts his arm around me, and we get this photo, and he's like, I love playing the McCallum, and, you know, let's do this again next year. And so he was in a great mood, which is fantastic, because it's not always been that way. But catch him on a good night.
All right, well, I'll come back. He's coming this season.
He'll be next season, yeah.
Wait, what's the date? Give me the date.
It's January of 25.
Okay. So January 25. Yeah.
There's three seats open in that box up there.
That's right. You can join me. You can sit in my box.
Oh, I would be honored to do that.
Absolutely.
And then you can go down and meet Paul.
And then you can wave to the audience.
He'll be you again.
Yeah. Well, he'll probably, you know, I'll probably go and he'll say that to me.
I'm the guy that hired you?
Yeah, that's right. I'm writing the check, so.
But, you know, we've got David Foster and Catherine McPhee coming back.
That's a big one every year.
Don't they have a house here?
They have a house in Indian Wells. Yeah. And I always love the fact that, you know, David will always do something for the hospital gala. And, you know, I'm assuming he's donating his time for the hospital so that they can raise money. And then I pay him an enormous amount of money to come to the McCallum. So I always have that in the back of my mind with
you
Mr.
Should
Foster.
Say, oh, by the way, tonight we're doing a fundraiser for Eisenhower. Yeah. So.
But the thing about David Foster is, like, there's probably not a song from the 1990s that he didn't have some part of, whether writing or arranging or producing, and it was, you know, it's an amazing body of work. I mean, I don't know what he's done lately, but back then he was a big, you know,
he married Catherine McPhee, yeah, is what he's done lately.
Well, he's taken him to another level. Yeah,
that was a pretty good decision on his part.
Which act sells out fastest?
Oh my gosh. Well, it depends, you know, because like the one-nighters will sell out quickly. And it's you know, I know that this next season, probably the fastest one that'll sell out will be Yo-Yo Ma, because it's got a huge audience, and we have, you know, one performance. But the Broadway shows do really well. I think you know, something like Paul Anka will probably sell out very, very quickly. It's the more popular stuff.
Got it.
Yeah.
We had Richard J. Alexander on our as a guest, and he helped produce Les Mis and Miss Saigon, and he is, you know, he's a huge Broadway guy, and so he said, you know, that's where the so have you guys beefed up your Broadway? Like, are you adding more of those shows?
Well, we are, and I book as many Broadway shows as I possibly can, but. It all depends on the calendar and on the routing and stuff. Also, you know,
because those big traveling shows, there's a lot of logistics. And you mentioned that Les Mis was like 11 trucks.
It was 11 trucks, and one of them didn't show up.
So what did they miss? Did they not have the bridge that Javert jumps off of?
It was the floor. So we were supposed they were supposed to be here on a Monday to load in all day Monday, and then all day Tuesday for a Tuesday night opening. So they got here on Monday. And they realized that one of the trucks that they sent down from Spokane was empty. And they had air tagged all their trucks. And they realized that the truck with all the set material was still in Spokane. So they get a driver to drive all night from Spokane. We had to cancel the first night.
Oh my God.
We didn't open until Wednesday. So we had a 7-show week and 7-8 show week. But it was an amazing production, and it's a massive, you know, a massive. I think 11 trucks. I mean, it's the biggest show that's been at the theater since I've been there. But a show like Les Mis, you know, the producers basically they want all the money. So that's one of those things where I wanted that show on the season. It lent a lot to the season. So, you know, we gave them all the money.
It's my favorite Broadway show.
It's a great show.
It's and this so was
a
incredible.
It was a really good production. But people ask me, you know, when are you going to have Hamilton? When are you going to have Wicked? And the
when are you going to have Hamilton and Wicked?
the answer is we can't gross enough. You know, to get a show like Wicked, you have to be able to gross like $1.7 million a week has to be your gross potential. We have 1,100 seats. To gross $1.7 million, our lowest ticket price would have to be $175 up to probably $300. And I don't know that I could, you know,
you might have a revolt on your
hands. I don't think that works. Ticket prices have been going up and up and up, and it's only because that's what I have to pay for the acts. When Broadway, between last year and this year, the cost to me of Broadway shows went up between 18% and 21%. Between this year and next year, they've gone up another 20%. So the only thing I can do is raise the ticket prices, and it's unfortunate, but that's, you know, that's the reality of it. So shows like Wicked and Hamilton, we won't see until they basically come down from those kind of numbers. And they'll come down from those kind of numbers when they don't get those numbers anymore.
Right.
Yeah. So I had a call from Disney a couple of years ago. They said, we'd like to bring the Lion King to the McCallum. And I said, we don't have a center aisle. One of the big things with Lion King is that they all go down the center aisle. Well, we're continental seating, so we don't have a center aisle. So they said, oh, well, we've reconfigured the opening of the show so that you don't need a center aisle. And I said, so you've basically gone to every theater in the country that has a center aisle, and you've gone through all of those, and now you want to come to the rest of them. But they still, you know, it was still one of these things where, well, you know, show us a gross of 1.2, and it's just, yeah.
Can't do it.
So, but a show like Book of Mormon, when Book of Mormon first toured, it's, again, they wanted all the money. We waited 10 years from the time it opened. It opened in 2010, maybe. It was about 10 years before we were able to get Book of Mormon. And sometimes you just, you know, you wait. So,
but it was probably a good wait, because 10 years ago, the intervening 10 years made it more acceptable. Like, I think maybe your audience, when it first came out here in the desert, would not have.
Yeah, it might have been. But the producer of Les Mis, the fellow from Cameron McIntosh's office in New York, came to see the show at the McCallum, and he loved it because this is the smallest theater they've played in, and he loved how intimate it was. And he told me that they were going to redo Phantom of the Opera so that it could fit in the McCallum. And I said, when can I have it? And he told me 2029. So I will not be here, but you guys can get a ticket to Phantom of the Opera in 2029.
He says he won't be here.
Yeah.
But he said that several times.
He said that before.
We're going to be sitting in a box with him in 2029 watching Phantom of the Opera.
Well, one of us will be.
Good point. I'll be waving to both of you.
I was like, oh, Mitch, that's a nice seat you gave Randy. That's good. You can almost make him out for me up here.
I'm so glad we got Mitch on today.
I know. Well, I think the McCallum has more appearances on Big Conversations Little Bar than any other organization in the Valley.
Well, I'm glad to hear
Congratulations.
Well, thank you.
You can go
thank
back you. And tell everybody that works at the McCallum.
I will. I will.
Well, this is exciting. It's a great new season that you put together. And I always enjoy having you on Eye of the Desert because you always bring great stuff. And so it's much nicer to have a longer conversation to be able to really flesh things out.
Yeah, this was fun. Now I'm going to have to go back and see what stories I told that I shouldn't have.
Well, thank you very much.
I didn't mention President Ford and Whoopi Goldberg, did I?
Yeah, just once, but it was. And you cleaned it up really nice. Oh, yeah. I don't think Whoopi would like it, but President Ford would love it.
There you go.
So.
Well, it's been fun. Thank you for inviting me.
Mitch Gershenfeld, the president and CEO of McCallum Theater, one of the premier entertainment venues in the Coachella Valley, and it truly is. You guys. From its inception and that incredible performance with Frank Sinatra on the stage, I mean, this is just a historical point, you know, where everybody should go see a show at the McCallum and get your season tickets.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, McCallumTheater.org. If I don't have a full screen, I'm in trouble. McCallumTheater.org. You can call the box office. So, my thanks to John McMullen, our producer. Randy, another incredible episode.
We got through another episode. They let us keep coming back.
Yes, indeed. And our thanks to Skip Page and his entire team at Little Bar. They do a great job, and they are our host each week for this. So, yeah, another episode will drop right here at your favorite podcast outlet. And, of course, you can subscribe, and you can find us at BigConversationsLittleBar.com. Thank you, guys, and we'll see you next time right here on Big Conversations Little Bar.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Big Conversations Little Bar. Recorded on location at Skip Page's Little Bar in Palm Desert, California, the center of the Coachella Valley universe. This program is a production of the Mutual Broadcasting System. All episodes are available from BigConversationsLittleBar.com or from most major podcast portals, including Apple, Spotify, and Amazon Music.